your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back, continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed that lengthy discussion with Richard Postma, a.k.a. Doc. We covered a lot of the markets and a lot on the precious metals. I'm going to focus on the resource sector here as I am chatting with Matt Geiger. He is the managing partner over at MJG Capital. Matt, you run a focused resource, even now precious metals, more focused fund. That's because, hey, precious metals have been running. I haven't chatted with you for a number of months. Let's get your general comments on the strength of the precious metals market. Gold closed the week pretty much right at $1,900. It's up hundreds of dollars from that low just a couple years ago. Silver also had a good start to the week, but silver's way off of its highs compared to where gold is. What's your assessment of both gold and silver, please?
Hey, Corey, good to be back on the program here. To your point, I was just looking at the date of our last interview, and I think we talked in the last week of February. Maybe we mentioned coronavirus once or twice in that interview, but boy, has the world changed in the month since. That really does feel like a world away. So it's good to be back with you. Yeah, obviously, it's been a pretty euphoric few months here for those of us involved in the precious metal space, whether you're holding physical metals or, you know, whether you're investing in miners or in my case, more in the junior niche of the market, we're seeing it really explode to life, particularly in the junior space. I'd say over the past eight to 10 weeks, we're starting to see some significant capital inflows. I think of those of us that have been following this market closely for a while have been waiting for this. I mean, sure, a lot has changed. There's a lot of uncertainty out there around the global economy, around the effect of COVID and what that's going to rot on the world in terms of geopolitical tensions, racial tensions. There's a lot going on right now. And generally, in times of volatility and uncertainty, gold will perform quite well. And then there's, of course, the other factor, which is low or negative interest rates across the world. If you're looking at the United States, we've been negative real rates for quite some time, and we're teetering just on the edge of zero in terms of the Fed rate. And so all of these are conducive to owning precious metals. Obviously, the lower interest rates are the less of an opportunity cost of owning gold or gold-related equities. I think the narrative's been in place for a while, and, you know, due to a confluence of factors, people are finally catching on to the trend. The prices have gone up of both the metals and the equities, and now the price rise is justifying the narrative. And so you're finally starting to see generalists start to rotate into the space. It's a bit of a bittersweet feeling, I would say. It probably means that we're certainly not at the beginning of the precious metals bull market that began, I would argue, in early 2016, probably closer to the fourth or fifth inning, potentially a little bit later in the game even. I think I'm confident saying that we're probably going to have at least another good 18 months to go for investors in both gold and silver. Obviously, that's subject to change. That is my best guess at the moment for where we're at in the current cycle. You did mention silver. silver bugs are a particular type of crazy, but I can see the allure of that particular metal at this point in time. To be honest, I'm a bit surprised how well it's done in recent weeks. I was thinking due to depressed global industrial demand that we would see silver lag gold for a little bit longer than it has, but it's played catch up in a real way. And if you want to look at it from a glass half full perspective, you could say that silver, the silver price action is validating this precious metals bull market we're seeing. Final point. Gold is at this point at $1,900 an ounce. It sounds crazy to say that after waiting years. We're really a stone's throw away from the all-time high in U.S. dollars. From a silver perspective, though, it's worth noting that silver prices would have to more than double to hit the $49, $50 level that it's peaked at twice in the past 30 years before retreating pretty significantly. So I can see the excitement around silver, but investors should be careful. The euphoria is quite palpable.
Hey, fair enough. You know what? Silver has very much lagged gold, but even look at some of the gold mining stocks or look at the ETFs. GDXJ is still 160% off of its all-time highs, and that's when gold was almost a decade ago, right around current levels. So still arguably some catch-up to do. You even mentioned you focus a lot on junior companies, and in the last about 2 months, maybe it's only been a month, we've started to see juniors move higher. Even companies that hadn't issued news since the beginning of the year, their stock prices were doubling. Fine, they're still at very low levels compared to maybe a few years ago, but what's your assessment of the bounce that we've seen in the juniors that hasn't exactly just been selective juniors?
Right. Well, this is, again, bittersweet as well. You know, a lot of the junior space, and I've said this before, the vast majority of these companies are not investable. So investors should be extremely selective with the management teams that they choose to work with. And I think that's better for the industry at large. However, you know, what we're seeing is the Vancouver paper mill is fired up and it's ready to go. And there's a lot of new companies being issued. A lot of insiders are getting very cheap stock and you know, pushing that out onto retail investors that are bidding it into the 10 and 20 and 30 cent range and sometimes higher. So, of course, this is all fun and good while it's occurring. But to me, I think the industry, the more disciplined the industry stays and the more disciplined investors are, the longer this run should go on. But I think if we get too aggressive and start throwing money at anything that looks like it can make a quick profit, we're doing both ourselves as investors a disservice, but also the industry at large. So, you know, I know I'm one tiny voice out here in the wind, and as the excitement continues to build, I'll get drowned out more and more. But I would just encourage people to really stick with the high quality management teams as much as they can, and to really resist the temptation, even if there's easy money to be made in a quick promote. Just to stay disciplined and to focus on teams that are trying to create real value, that have been at it for a while, that are well incentivized, you know, that are averaged in at a share price that's close to you, and aren't distracted with four or five different deals. I think the longer that investors can focus on those types of companies, you know, the less likely we are to have a 2016 like event where, you know, things just go ballistic for 9 months and then, you know, there's a 2-3 year hangover afterwards.
Yeah, we don't want to see a replay of 2016, but hey, this run for stocks and the metals has now gone on for almost 2 years. So that's something to also consider. When it comes to management teams, I completely agree with you. One, make sure these management teams just didn't get a ton of cheap shares, which really just blows out the share price. Really just blows out the share structure. But when it comes to past success, does the focus really just have to be on them either building a mine or, even better, selling a company in the relatively recent past?
Yeah, I think that's one of the easiest things to look at. I mean, it's helpful to have and of course, some of these management teams are household names, right? And so I would never... it's very easy to invest with a Ross Beaty or a Robert Friedland or some of these other serially successful names that are out there. And I think even in this in market environment, it's probably worth paying up to be involved with people that have done this before and have made shareholders money on multiple occasions. Now, I think it's okay to go further, you know, afield as well. Not everybody's had 4, 5, 6 major, you know, successes under their belt. But yeah, look at the CEO's last couple deals. Reach out to investors that you know were involved with those past companies, if you're able to, and get their feedback. Did it make money for them? You know, was management putting in 100% into the deal, or were they distracted with other money making ventures? If things didn't go well, why was that the case? Was it due to poor decision making? Was it due to poor ethics? Or was the management team truly taking a legitimate risk and it just didn't happen to pay off? Maybe a permit that was expected to come through didn't, or an exploration thesis that did have a lot of merit and a lot of excitement surrounding it just didn't pan out. So you should consider all of these things when evaluating management teams. But again, I mean, very simple things to look at would be how much money have they put into the deal themselves? What's their average cost per share? Are they issuing themselves a bunch of cheap options in addition to their initial position? And really looking at focusing on teams with 10, 15, 20% board and management positions, they solve it solves a lot of ills. This is not always the case, but generally when you see that type of skin in the game from a management team, you're going to see lower G&A in total for the company. It's less likely that you're going to see stock options thrown left and right. It's less likely that the company is going to blow all of their money on promotion. When management has that vested stake, they want to put that money into the ground and actually try to drive true value. So it's a very simple thing to look at, but I think it just does a world of wonder if you can just narrow your opportunity set to those with management teams with double digit ownership, and you're not investing at a 5 or 6 or 10x uplift to their average cost per share.
Okay, hey, fair enough. That is something to find. It's all public information, or at least a lot of that is. What about these drill plays too? Drilling has been driving these stocks. Some companies issue a good drill result, and I've seen stocks double in a day. The market is clearly paying attention. What do you look for in a drill program outside of obviously the strong management team?
Sure. Well, taking a step back, I do feel that we're in store for a pretty strong exploration and discovery market here. It's really been close to two decades since we've had a market like this. Even if you look at the 2002 to 2007 commodity boom, the major beneficiary there were the optionality plays. The companies with large pre-existing deposits, ounces or pounds already in the ground, and then seeing massive re-ratings on their share prices based off of rising metal prices. I think investors have learned their lesson quite painfully based off of what happened both in 2007, 2008, and then the even bigger bust from 2012 through 2015. And I think in this upcoming market, investors are going to focus, if you're looking on the development side of things, on high-quality projects that can make money at spot metal prices, don't cost too much to build, and you can get a quick payback, 3-4 years, hopefully even quicker than that. And then on the exploration side of things, you want to be looking for companies that are searching for these types of deposits and are in the right neck of the woods, and aren't just flogging, a fourth generation project that's already been through three cycles, won't be built in this cycle. Sure, maybe you can get an uplift if the gold price continues to run. So for the exploration plays, that's what I'm sticking to. Now I will say we have a bias, I'd say, to two different business models. The first is the prospect generation business model. And if we're trying to bet on a new discovery that hasn't been made yet, that is almost always the way that we go about it. As you know, exploration is an incredibly risky game here. Even the best stock pickers are going to lose far more than they win. And I'm just not a fan of betting on single asset explorers. We have a couple in the portfolio, but as a whole, I do like the prospect generation business model, getting multiple shots on target. A big discovery, even if you own only 20% of it, can make fortunes for a 10 or 20 or $30 million prospect generator. So that's one way to play it. And another way to play it that's also very valid strategy is to go for the post-discovery plays. Now, this takes a certain amount of attention, of course. You have to be following the news wires extremely closely. And you also have to have some intuition. Even if you're not a tried and true geologist, you either need to have that experience to recognize what looks like it could be an economic hit or could be leading to an economic deposit, or you need the connections to be able to bounce ideas off of them. But the idea is that you scan the market, you keep an eye on all these single project explorers, you don't buy them ahead of the discovery, but when you see that occasional major hit, when you said, there could be something serious here, this is not looking like a $50 or $100 million deposit, if they continue in this vein, there could be real value created, you jump in right there. in the 12, 24, 48 hours after that drill hole and hold on for dear life. And in this market, those types of stories have been working quite well.
Yeah, fair enough. Hey, there's been some very nice moves in good stories, but also in some of these stories that I think people are just looking for any sort of cheap paper out there, and that can actually move stocks higher. I want to get a quick comment from you regarding your trading strategy when it comes to warrants. I know not everybody holds warrants, but I know the investing that you do in some of these companies to get your positions, you do take part in private placements, you get warrants along with those. This recent run-up in stocks has put a number of companies with warrants in position for those warrants to be exercised. How do you trade a stock or invest in a stock where you hold shares, you also hold warrants, and now the warrants are in the money?
So I don't have a cut and dry formula for this. I think the most important thing to look at, and this is what you do as an investor holding common shares as well, at least if you have a value investor orientation, you need to understand where the company's at in its life cycle, where the current share price is, what you believe the either intrinsic value is or the speculative value per share, and the delta between where the current share price is and where you think it should be at this stage. And so even if you have warrants that are well in the money, if it's a company where you have conviction, extreme conviction that it can go up another 2 or 3x, I'd be happy to hold that entire position. So again, no hard and fast rules on warrant exercising. Of course, if it's well in the money and you see the share price start to get close to what you view as fair value, that's a good opportunity to exercise and take your money off the table, or partially exercise, and then maybe exercise the rest six months thereafter. I think another thing to think about is just position sizing in your overall portfolio. We have a pretty hard and fast rule where we don't want, if we can avoid it, this can be sometimes difficult. But with private names, we don't want any position to be above 20% of our overall portfolio. To be more specific, 10% at cost and then 20% at market. So we could take a 10% position. I'd be comfortable for it to double in price. But if it starts rising from there, I'm going to want to take profits continually on the way up. And so that can also be a way to stay disciplined and not get too greedy with these warrants. Just make sure that you have position sizing rules. And that can do a good job of keeping you in check. And then the final point I'll make is obviously the date till expiry is extremely important. So, even warrants well in the money, if there's still another 3 or 4 years to go, I'm going to be less inclined to just reflexively exercise and then dump the shares immediately. Maybe you'd want to, in that case, even if it's well in the money, take half your money off the table again and let the rest ride. But I know other investors that are a lot more aggressive in exercising their warrants. I respect that strategy, and that's been a good strategy in the 12 years that we've just lived through. But in these kind of bull market scenarios, you can leave quite a bit of money on the table if you just have a hard and fast rule to exercise the warrants and get out, as soon as you get double your initial capital. I don't think it's as simple as having a single formula. I think you have to look at each of it on a case-by-case basis.
All right, Matt, we're going to wrap it up there. Thank you for joining us on this weekend show. Interesting comments, and hey, a much better environment for junior mining or junior resource stocks. It's nice to see. Hey, Matt, I'm going to have you back on in probably a couple months, but in the meantime, everyone stick around. I'm going to be right back to wrap up the show with a quick company update. Thanks for your time, Matt. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Corey. Good to be on.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment.